Right.
Well, for the last several weeks, 2 months or so, I have been making the case that a lot of the tension that we perceive between the church and the world boils down to the fact that we are telling different stories about everything. We believe two different stories about what it means to be human and the kind of world that we live in and how it works and what is wrong with the world. And then based on what's wrong with the world, what then is the solution? What's needed in the world? So those are the four questions that we've been looking at. James, you might have to punch it for me. Those are the four questions that we've been looking at. Who are we? Where are we? What's wrong? And what is the solution? And for the last couple of weeks, we have been looking at the what is wrong question. James, you want to pull those up for us? So we've been looking at what is wrong for the last couple of weeks, and today we're going to start looking at the what is the solution. So today, I was going to ask you, you might be able to come up with other answers. If you were going to ask the world, if you were going to ask your neighbors, your friends, your coworkers, what's like the biggest problem in the world today? What kinds of things might you hear? Okay.
Along those lines, I was thinking of all the bullying. It seems that that's just gotten so much more, and that suicide is so much higher than it has been.
Okay, so two sides of the same coin, mm-hmm. or two sides of the same dice. There are lots of sides to the social media thing.
Hopelessness.
Hopelessness. Okay.
Selfishness. It's all about me.
Selfishness. Okay. Apparently you're asking your Christian neighbors. that's not what I was trying to ask.
The problem is who forgot about God.
Okay.
The economy is probably a lot of people's mind.
Okay, the economy. So let's put the list back up. Here are just ones that I think you would probably hear something about. Economic inequality, the fact that Americans consume so much and then there are other parts of the world where people live on beans. Overconsumption. Religion's the problem. We got to get rid of religion. Prejudice. And man, there's all kinds of things that would fall under the heading of prejudice. And then you would hear some people who would say, well, sexual liberation or something like that is the problem. And then you would have other people who say, well, this sort of religious obsession with sexuality and trying to control sexuality, that's the real problem. So two approaches to the same kind of thing. If you were going to ask this question, let's say 40 years ago, 50 years ago, let's go back to mid-70s, early 80s, what answers would you have heard then? I wasn't around then, so this is a genuine question. I confess my naivety.
There was lines to get gas in the 70s.
Lines to get gas, okay. So there's a problem. So is that a financial problem, or is that like a resources problem?
I think it's a government problem.
Okay, I heard government, I heard resources.
That's what I remember of it. Supposedly we had a gas shortage.
Okay.
But it was economic. I mean, it was high inflation. It was, it actually had limits on what you could charge for milk. Okay, it's just crazy. But I'll tell you, because I was working in corporate America, inequality the way women were treated.
Okay.
And it was a big thing.
Okay. So the treatment of women in the workplace. And the mobility of women in the workplace, I would imagine, was a big upward mobility, the ability to climb. Oh, okay.
Racial inequality. Racial inequality was a problem too. It wasn't as acknowledged as it is know, we were not far out of
the civil rights
schools
movement.
Schools and, yeah. and things like that.
Okay.
We had a Cold War.
Yeah.
I heard that, I don't know if any of you did this, if the timing is right, but some students, you know, you had your tornado drills, and then you would practice hiding from nuclear warheads under the formica of your, under your desk. That'll protect you.
With a book over your neck.
So, these are just a few examples, past and present, things that people think, well, if we could just fix that, then everything would be utopian. We would be so much better off if we didn't have that, or if we could just achieve this. So what is the solution then? If these are the problems, and again, we're just going to stick with the five that I have listed, not because these are the right answers, but because those are the ones that I have listed. If those are the problems, what would be the solution? Okay, well, again, we're asking your neighbors, we're asking your coworkers, we're asking your unbelieving nephew. How do we fix this?
Some of them would say we need pay raises.
Pay raises?
That economic inequality, or they need to reduce prices, or...
Or they would say equality of outcome would be catchphrase. Is that everybody needs to be equal when you...
Okay. Begin. Okay.
It was the establishment, man.
The establishment.
The establishment. I've heard my grandfather say that.
The man. Yeah.
Seventies talk there.
Holding me back.
Any other things that come right to mind?
I think it would take a couple generations of education.
Education?
Start with our children and teach them about equality. And taking care of our earth and how we take care of each other. This all has to start from the bottom up. There is no fix for it until we educate our people to do it right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it seems so naive, but if we could teach more about caring and about love and about compassion, I think that would feed into every one of them.
Hmm. Well, perhaps we'll unpack a little of that this morning. So, James, let's throw up, again, not an exhaustive list, but some of the things that I have noticed. Man, let's legislate. We got problems. Maybe if we could get the government to set a cap on how much you can charge for milk, Alice. Or maybe if we could mandate pay raises. Or if we could mandate certain things. Or forbid certain things through legislation, that would fix it all. Awareness. I always chuckle when I am watching a football game and I see on the back of someone's helmet the words "end racism." And I think, that'll do it. Just write it on the back of your helmet. That'll fix everything. But that comes from this belief that if we can raise awareness, and I think education is part of that, maybe. But just bringing it to people's attention. Because I think if you can bring things to people's attention, then they do sometimes make changes. Right? That's why we try to bring things to people's... That's why I'm bringing this to your attention. Hoping that this will make an impact on the way that you live. Business. Business is one way that we try to correct things. Reason. Persuasion. Although I think we're starting to lose faith in the ability of reason to change people's minds. Which, what does that say about society? Yikes. And then violence. Violence has always seemed to be a pretty good motivator, or at least we think it's going to be a good motivator. But there are so many examples to the contrary where violence doesn't seem to accomplish what the aggressor wants it to accomplish. So, you guys see where I'm going with this, or at least where I'm coming from. The world believes there are certain problems. This is what's wrong. And if this is what's wrong, then here's the way that you try and fix it. But what if we had a different understanding of what the problem is? Then we would be looking for different kinds of solutions. So let's remind us, James, of what the problem is. First of all, humans are unwise. This is what we've looked at for the last couple of weeks. What we see in Genesis 1 through 3, we've been digging into those first three chapters of the Bible. And the fundamental problem, I've been arguing, is that humans are unwise. Adam and Eve, and all humans, are not born with wisdom or knowing right from wrong. We have to learn wisdom. But the thing is, not every source is a reliable source. Not every source is going to lead us down the right path that leads to flourishing. So who are we going to learn wisdom from is an important question there. Second is distrust of God. In the garden, humans distrust God. They choose to trust themselves, and they choose to trust the serpent who tells them to trust themselves. I would argue that distrust or unfaith is the fundamental human problem that generates every other problem that we've articulated. Last week we looked at some of the effects of what's wrong, this alienation from God. Because humans sin in the garden, they immediately hide from God, and then when God finds them, he sends them out of the garden. But the net result of that hiding and banishment is that we're separated from God. We're built for this Sabbath communion with God, but that's not the reality that we experience. The reality that we experience is alienation, which means that we're always living in this kind of subhuman existence. We also talked about alienation from each other, that humans hide from one another because of our lack of wisdom, and our relationships get distorted, but we are made for unity. Human community, which is a mirror of God's own self. God is the three in one. He is an eternally existing community of self-giving love. And we are made in his image. And so when we are fully functioning humans, we are doing it in community. But what happens as a result of sin is that we're alienated, isolated from each other. And then last is we're alienated from creation. Human sin has affected creation, which now is accursed and hostile. So if these are the problems, and we've meditated on these for the last couple of weeks, if these are the problems, what are the kinds of solutions we might expect the Bible to present to us? This is low-hanging fruit here. Take a wild guess. If humans are unwise, what do you think needs to happen?
We ask God for his wisdom.
Say again?
Wisdom from the Word.
From God?
Pray for wisdom.
Pray for wisdom, James. Humans have to become wise about what's good and what's evil. Somehow, and we're just going to put a pin in the question of how for a moment, but somehow, humans have to become wise. We have to learn what is good and what's evil and move past this naivety, which means, at some point, coming to terms with our own inadequacy and agreeing that God's judgment was right. When God says, they can't do this exercising judgment of right and wrong, eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and live forever. That will be disaster. We have to come to this agreement that, yeah, when we act on our own ignorance, God was right. It will lead to disaster. And I have to listen to him and let him teach me. If the problem is distrust of God, what is the solution? Take a wild swing. Trust God. There we go. Got to trust in God. This, and I think this gets to the heart of it. How can this be accomplished? One of the fundamental questions that has been up for grabs in church history is, can humans simply will themselves to trust God or not? Or is even that trust a gift of God? And I tend to think that it is. And there are problems with that, but I think that's the best reading of the text. If alienation from God is a problem, what also needs to happen? Okay, reunion with God. We've been isolated from God. Somehow God and humans have to get back together. If we've been alienated from each other, then somehow what needs to happen? There needs to be unity with each other, reunion with each other. And then if creation has been stained, cursed, affected, then somehow there needs to be a redemption of creation. It is God's job. All of this is God's job. Yeah, God is the one who will bring all of this about. And that's actually the title of my class this morning is What God Has Done. What God has done to solve the problems. So, how are these solutions different from the solutions that we talked about that the world is wants to use to try and solve the problems?
Looking up instead of sideways.
Okay, it looks up.
Horizontal, not vertical.
Yeah, we're looking somewhere else. Yeah, we're looking somewhere else for help, for solution.
And I think the world is so into competition and winning, and they look at it as a win-lose, and so it's difficult because there's not the team effort and the I'll help you and we'll all get along.
As Christians, do we believe in the value of legislation? Or do we say, legislation, smegislation?
I think we need some of it.
Some of it?
Yes, we do.
Yes?
Heaven has a pearly gate. I'm just going to throw that out there. There's a wall.
There's a wall. Okay. How about one that maybe is a little less sensitive? Reason. Do we believe in the value of reason? I hope that you believe in the value of reason and rationality. It is not all important, but it is valuable. So it's not that we don't value these solutions that the earth or that the world is leaning on. It's just that we believe that those in themselves are not going to fix the problems, because there is a deeper core set of problems that's generating the stuff up at the surface. If there's economic inequality, it's because there's something else deeper going on in the human heart, and that has to be dealt with. If there's prejudice, okay, there's a reason for that that goes deeper into the human heart, and that has to be fixed first. And then out of that, okay, well, perhaps then we do work with legislation, or of course, that's a big debate also. But there are other things, other solutions, ways of life that we might pursue. James, are you?
Well, we heard the old phrase, you can't legislate morality.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that's designed to keep, you know, church from state, thing like that. But the root, like you're saying, go to the heart. A lot of it is they don't want things to be shaped by morality. Because there's not a real belief in a set of absolutes. They're shaping up.
Okay, so let's go to think more about what is the solution, and how does the Bible start to move us toward these solutions that we're kind of expecting? By the time you finish chapter 3 of Genesis, you've already been exposed to who we are, and what kind of world we live in, and what the problems with it are, and the consequences of sin and human foolishness. And so we're already primed, like, well, these are the things that need to be fixed. We humans need to become wise, and we need to somehow come to trust in God, and our relationship with God needs to be fixed, and our relationship with each other and with the earth needs to be fixed. And then we turn the page to chapter 4 and we're starting to think, how is this going to happen? That's the question we should have in our minds as we come to chapter 4. And much of the rest of the Bible is occupied with this question, how are things going to be put to right? And so I want to draw your attention to two stories that follow right on the heels of the Garden of Eden that are working through this question. The first one is the story of Cain and Abel. Somebody summarize the story of Cain and Abel for me. Prove to me that you went to Sunday school when you were in fourth grade and you know the story.
They brought the sacrifices to God and God found favor with Abel tonight. Cain's and Cain killed Abel because he's jealous.
Okay. So two brothers, they both bring sacrifices. God favors one but not the other. And the one who's not favored kills his brother out of jealousy. Is that a fair summary? Is there any more to it than that? It's a trick question. There's always more to it than that, right? There's always more to it than that.
Class, thank you.
All right. So, a question that maybe you thought about, maybe you haven't. Why are Cain and Abel, the sons of Adam and Eve, why are they offering sacrifices at all? You don't know?
Yeah, it's because of original sin, right? I mean, sacrifices weren't needed before the snake and the apple.
Okay, but what does the sacrifice accomplish? To what end do they sacrifice?
To please God.
To please God?
We assume that God had given instruction on the need to sacrifice.
Okay. You have a Bible. Open to Genesis chapter 4. If you have a Bible. I didn't say the if strong enough. If you have a Bible. Genesis 4. Now, Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again, she bore his brother Abel. Now, Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering. But for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. And the Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, notice, sin is crouching where?
At the door.
Where do you put doors? You don't put doors in the middle of a room, do you, Steve? Where do you put a door?
At the outside.
At a wall? At some sort of boundary? Well, what happened right at the end of chapter 3? Adam and Eve are banished out of the garden, and they cross the threshold out of the garden, and God puts a cherub there and a flaming sword to protect the entrance to the Garden of Eden. And now God says sin is crouching at the door. What is the purpose of sacrifice? I mean, if you think about like Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, the purpose of sacrifice is to commune with God, and ultimately, like in the symbolism of the priesthood and the high priesthood, it is so that I can vicariously, through the high priest, so that I can re-enter the garden. When the high priest crosses the curtain and goes into the most holy place on that one day, once a year, he is symbolically re-entering the Garden of Eden. The purpose of sacrifice is to make the worshiper clean so that they can re-enter into the garden. You see what Cain and Abel are trying to do here? They've been banished. Their parents were banished. And now sin is crouching at the door, trying to keep them out. But sacrifice, apparently, is a way that they have found or been instructed or something that is potentially going to get them back in. But the one who did it right, what happens to him? He doesn't make it. And then you have Cain, who is banished further and further from the garden.
But it says that he brought forth fruit of the ground, but it says that Abel brought the firstlings of his flock.
Mm-hmm.
He brought the best, and it makes me wonder if Cain brought the best. Was it, I don't know what God had told him, but was it the fact that he brought vegetation, the problem? I know it's a heart problem, I got that part, but was it that he was just sort of punching his ticket as opposed to obeying?
So is it the writer of Hebrews that talks about Cain? Abel offered his sacrifice by faith, but Cain did not. Okay, so faith is apparently part of, or perhaps the reason why God looks with favor on Cain, or on Abel, but not on Cain. So in the context of worship, we see the Eden story replaying itself. Cain does what is right in his own eyes, and then God comes looking for him. You remember what happens after Adam and Eve do what's right in their own eyes? God comes looking for them. And Cain passes the buck. He doesn't say, well, it was this woman you gave me. But he does say, well, am I my brother's keeper? So he's trying to deflect culpability for his actions. And then there's a curse that's placed on the one who has sinned, and his relationship with God is affected, his relationship with others is affected as he's banished into the wilderness, and his relationship with the earth is affected. So that's one story. How's it going so far, this human attempt to re-enter the garden? So far it's not going great. Not going great. Here's a second story I want us to look at, chapter 11. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly, like Parker did with his green chili. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. That part's in the Hebrew about the chili. And they said, come, let's build a city and a tower with its top where? In the heavens. Where does God live? In the heavens. And let's make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the whole face of the earth. And the Lord came down to see this pitiful tower that they built, and the city, and the children of which the children of men had built. And the Lord said, behold, they're one people, they all have one language. This is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let's go down and confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth. And they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was Babel or Babylon, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. Okay. So after the flood, after Noah's flood in chapters 6 through 8, or 6 through 9, I guess, the humans build this giant tower that is supposed to reach all the way up to heaven. And that way, God will have a staircase by which to come down and enter a temple. It doesn't use the word temple here, but that's why humans did this. We have examples of this in the ancient world. The reason they built these towers was so that the deity would come down and enter the temple. the purpose of this tower is what? Circumvents the hard work of
restoring relationship with God.
Okay. So building a tower becomes a substitute for doing the hard work of learning to trust God and learn wisdom. Okay. What else might we say? What's the purpose of the tower?
It's
to do it their way. It's effectively, it's to re-enter the garden. Now, the garden isn't up in the sky somewhere, but it is for God and humans to come back together. It's for them to re-enter God's domain and commune with God. But does it work? No. It's so small, puny, that God has to, like, he can't even see with his binoculars what this tiny little thing is. Let's go down and see what's going on. So, the point here is that human attempts to resolve things won't work. By the time you finish chapter 11, you've already been exposed to what does it mean to be human, what kind of world do we live in, what's wrong with it, what kinds of solutions should we be looking for, and one thing we've learned is that human attempts are not going to work. If the world is going to be put to right, if we're going to be reunited with God and with each other, If creation's going to be redeemed, if we're going to learn to trust God and learn wisdom, somebody else is going to have to do the heavy lifting here. If the first problem that we identified was that humans are unwise, how does God fix that? As you think about the story of the Bible, how does God fix the problem of human wisdom or folly? It's kind of a trick question, and we're running out of time. So let's put up Deuteronomy chapter 4. Did we lose it? That's all right. Deuteronomy, you got it? All right, Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 and 6. Moses says, "See, I have taught you statutes and rules, as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land that you're entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, they're going to say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." Covenant is God's answer to the wisdom problem. The covenant spells out what is good and what is not good. Here, if you want to know the good and the evil that God was going to teach Adam and Eve, go read Deuteronomy. This is where he lays out the path to human flourishing. Lucky for us, we just covered Deuteronomy like last year in sermons and in classes. So we have all the answers now. We're all perfectly wise. At the end of the book, in chapter 28, he says, "All these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the voice of the Lord your God." And then he has this long list. "Blessed shall you be in the city. Blessed shall you be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of your womb and the abundance of your livestock and your mixing bowl and your kneading table and all of this stuff. It's all going to be blessed if you will just obey. If you will listen and do the commands." So if the humans obey the covenant, it will lead to flourishing. And if they don't obey the covenant, what will happen? Disaster will happen. Disaster. So the covenant, this is the way of life. Moses says in chapter 30, "I lay before you life and death. Choose life." In the end, does covenant actually work to redeem all things? Okay, you want to say it a little louder so that everybody can hear, people in the back? I thought I heard you answer that. No?
No.
Okay. No. It doesn't work. The covenant. Just God giving the covenant on tablets of stone and then copied again into parchment doesn't actually redeem all things. Why?
It says it right there, if you obey.
If you obey. But it seems like it's such a good deal if you obey. Why don't they just obey?
We know better.
Because sin is crouching at the door. Like, what kind of creature crouches? It's like a lion, right? Sin is like a lion that wants to pounce and devour you. The prophets recognize there's something going on in the human heart that actually prevents us from wanting to obey. And so if we're ever going to listen and obey the voice of the Lord our God, and if we're going to flourish, that thing on the inside has to be dealt with. It has to be killed, rooted out, cleansed. There are all kinds of images for what has to happen. But in the end, how does God solve the problem of alienation? Jesus. Yeah. Jesus is the solution to alienation. The covenant reveals wisdom, but the people can't seem to appropriate that wisdom. It's like you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You can lead Israel to the covenant, but you can't make him obey. Jesus is the ultimate answer to these problems. That was the first bell. We got 5 minutes. Let me just real quickly walk through, I think it's four passages about Jesus restoring all things. One is in Romans 5. He says, this is the Apostle Paul, "For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, much more now that we're reconciled, shall we be saved by his life." And then in Hebrews, "Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places," you realize what that's about. We already talked about the whole thing with sacrifice. The priest enters into the holy place. This is a symbol of entering into the garden. We have confidence to enter into the garden, the holy places, by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh. And since he's done that, let us draw near. Let's pause there for a second. So God has reconciled us to himself by his Son. He has taken upon himself the requisite penalty for human sin. And he has conquered that power of sin that leads us away from him. And he's opened the way for God, or for humans, to commune with God without shame and without fear and without pride and without self-righteousness. And by the blood of Jesus, we are invited to approach. The distance between us and God is overcome. Let's look at Ephesians. We've been going through Ephesians on Wednesday nights now for several weeks. So if you have been coming on Wednesdays, this should sound familiar. "For he himself is our peace, who has made us both one, Jew and Gentile, and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility." So God has reconciled us to each other. Before Jesus, you have the Jew and you have Gentiles. And actually, the Gentiles is a broad term that encompasses every ethnicity that is not Jewish. That's what Gentile means. But even within Gentiles, there's Parthians, Medes, Elamites, Egyptians, Coptics, and you can just go on and on and on. But Paul just calls them all Gentiles and says God has taken the Jew and the Gentile and has brought them together and made one new human, so that there's no longer division. When you read Genesis 1 through 11, One of the really tough chapters to get through is chapter 10. It's the Table of Nations. It's where all of the nations of the earth come from after the garden, or after the flood. And it's a lot of names. That's what makes it really hard. It's a lot of names. But the whole point of that is it's like a map of the ancient world and how fractured it becomes immediately. And now in Ephesians, Paul says all of that fracturing is healed. Because the Jew is saved by faith in Jesus and the Gentile is saved by faith in Jesus. And if we're both saved by the same grace, then there's no room for division anymore. And then last passage, Romans 8. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it. I believe that's Adam. In hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. Creation itself is a benefactor of, or a beneficiary of the redemptive work of Jesus. Okay, that's the time. Bell's going to ring here in just a second. Any parting thoughts, questions, comments?
I think when we look at how you change culture, you change culture one soul at a time for Christ. It's not a mass movement. You can't legislate it. You can't dictate it. You change hearts. And that's one soul at a time for Christ.
Let me say a prayer, and then we'll be done. Father, we thank you for the gift of your word. We thank you that you have indeed laid wisdom in front of us, not just in the covenant that continues to speak and have wisdom for us today, but through the example of your son, Jesus. Would you make us more like him? Would you give us hearts like his? And would you continue to come and root out and clean out the parts of our hearts that still do not trust you? And that still cling to our own pride and self-righteousness. Father, we love you. We need your grace. We confess this and pray this all through the name of our Lord Jesus. Amen.